Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Clive Anderson. Welcome to My Seven Wonders. In ancient times, the most impressive monuments, hanging gardens, and superstructures were lauded, listed, and visited as wonders of the world. And like seas, days of the week, and deadly sins, there were always seven of them. More modern lists of wonders have included elaborate human constructions, such as Machu Picchu and the Taj Mahal, or awesome natural phenomena, such as the Grand Canyon or the Great Barrier Reef. But what are the seven wonders you would put on your personal list? That's the question I ask my guests in this podcast. And the guest I'm asking today is the broadcaster Annika Rice, who shot to fame in the 1980s, running, flying and chasing around the country in Channel 4's all-action game show Treasure Hunt. Since which time she's had many other TV and radio successes, including several series of Challenge Annika, which is a big hit on BBC One. Now, knowing you a bit as I do, Annika, I would say you very much like a challenge. So Challenge Annika was a great title.
It was a very convenient title for me. And it was funny hearing you mention, you know, Treasure Hunt in the 80s and everything, because, of course, I had to, in my head, I have a huge career before that time, which is really significant to me.
Yes.
But I'm forever known And what the sweet thing is that everyone just thinks of Challenge and Helicopter as a big, and Treasure Hunt as a big amalgamation. I was in a helicopter. Kenneth Cundall was possibly there. There was a scout hut. You know, it's just an amalgamation of lots of programs, which is great. Before that, I was equally busy in a way.
Well, let's come to that, because you have to select your seven wonders, and your first wonder is the University of Life, which sounds like you had this tough upbringing in the School of Hard Knocks, the real world polytechnic, you know. But is that right? So University of Life means you like learning on the job rather than at an actual university.
Exactly that. And, you know, I don't want to make out myself, you know, this is no sob story, but I did have a pretty dysfunctional childhood, and where the rug was constantly being pulled from under my feet. And I had it ingrained into me by my mother, who was deeply unhappy in this very dysfunctional family I lived in. You know, you've got to make the most of your life, get out there and do stuff. And there were also lots of money problems. You know, at the time I was at Croydon High School, you know, just life wasn't, I always felt like a round peg in a square hole completely. I never fitted in anywhere. And the thought of actually applying to university, which obviously, if you go to a high school, it's highly academic, they expect to shoehorn you through Oxbridge. It just wasn't going to happen. I just had to get away from this life I was in, away from all the financial problems, and just make my own way. And so I had this vision that I was the heroine in the film of my life, and I would go to the University of Life, if you like. And I gave myself almost a time thing, because all my friends were, you know, taking their university entrance exams, and some of them sort of seemed to have things like ponies, you know, and very nice parents who sort of sat behind a newspaper on a Sunday, you know, and I just thought, I'm going to leave that world behind because I just don't fit into it. And I secretly applied to the BBC when I was 16.
Can we just, I noticed you went to more than one school, and I just on the off chance something extraordinary happened. Were you the sort of child that was expelled from lots of schools, or were you just your family travelling around and took you to different schools in Surrey?
What happened was that the school I was at, who were very accommodating of my dysfunctional life, because I was looking after a small baby when I was sort of 11, 12 onwards. So I'd have to take her to nursery and...
Whose baby was this? Not your baby at 11 or 12.
Sister. Yeah, not my own baby. But anyway, the school I was at, which was this very nice sort of school in the village I lived. Unfortunately, the year group I was in decided to try and burn it down. And so they set fire to the curtains in the common room. The police were called and everyone was expelled almost on the spot for arson. Now, me and Anne Ward Lee were at piano lessons, a couple of other people. So we turn up for school and there's literally four people. And so it was unsustainable to carry on. I mean, it was very good probably for the learning point of view, but I was very sporty and you can't really play a game of lacrosse with sort of two people. So I changed school. So that's why I changed school. It wasn't me that it was expelled. It was my entire year group.
That's an extraordinary story. Sounds like you've got a well worked out alibi anyway in the music lessons.
Honestly, Gov, it wasn't me. I was doing Chopin's Prelude in C or whatever. No, I just missed the whole action, though. Yeah. I was in there by association. But actually, I was always quite a sort of goody-goody at school because I had so much responsibility as a young child. As I say, I was looking after my sister. I cooked the family meals. I was really the family elastoplast in a way. And so I didn't have time to go smoking in common rooms.
No, you know? I would have imagined you might be sort of head girl or head of sport or something. But
yes, I was always very sporty and played lacrosse for the county and all that sort of stuff. But when I went to Croydon High School, the good thing was that it was very near my boyfriend, who I'd had for quite a few years, because more a friend than a boyfriend, really. But I was so attached to him and his family because I just loved this normal family. And so luckily he lived quite near Croydon, so I could snuggle in with his family, and it gave me the confidence to apply to the BBC and just move on with my life, if you like. So I joined. I went from this very sort of, you know, weird life where I'd only ever met people of my age who looked like me, into this extraordinary training program with the BBC. And I went straight into the World Service. And within, you know, 3 weeks of my training, I had a stopwatch in my hand. I was in the studio on the line to India saying, hello, is that Delhi? This is London. And Mark Tully would come on. And I suddenly got such a feeling of the world. And
right,
people in saris in the canteen and Chinese people. And at the time, I remember I saw Rocky Horror Show practically about 18 times. And I just thought, this is what it's all about. I just want to escape into the anonymity of the world, if you like, and I could leave everything behind. And then my boyfriend and I split up. So I was so heartbroken that I just thought, after I'd done my 2-year training, I just bought a 1-way ticket to Hong Kong and just thought, I'll carry on my life there.
All right. Well, we've rather dwelt on the ball of your childhood and getting. I knew you went to Hong Kong when you were 19, which sounds like very enterprising. You come across as a very confident person, but it sounds like you were pretty confident even in your teens.
I was very confident because I just didn't care. You know, if you've got nothing to lose, you don't care. And Jeopardy was my middle name. It was my default position, and so I joined the I went off to Hong Kong. I bluffed my way into so many jobs, Clive, you know, and all the time I was thinking, I must collect all these experiences because they're brilliant, because one day I'll write a book. You know, I am 15. It's quite a sort of weird thing to think. And I got a job, you know, PR company, not even knowing what PR was, literally, suddenly in charge of all these accounts. I suddenly had a sort of secretary. And then I got a job in the newsroom for the local English-speaking news station, and I was the sub-editor, so I was writing the scripts for all the news team. And then one day the newsreader was ill. I said, oh, I'll do that. Yes, I've done lots of that at the BBC. And there my presenting career was born, because in a way I thought, God, this is much easier than being the slogger in the back room writing the scripts. All I have to do is turn up and read the autocue.
And were you okay at reading autocue, especially in Hong Kong, where presumably there's quite a lot of names you might not have come across that feature in the news?
It was tricky, made more so by the fact that it was very much a DIY show, which is, you know, which put me in such good stead for all the rest of my career. You controlled the autocue with a foot pedal.
Oh, right.
It meant if you put it down too quickly, you zoomed from Taiwan to Macau, losing several stories in the middle. And the very first, and there was only one Chinese camera operator, and that was it. So I had no way to communicate. And the first night, Spike Milligan was in the news station for something else, and he came and sat under my desk by my feet very quietly for the entire newscast. Oh, and also on the way to the newsroom, I'd also run someone over by mistake. It wasn't really my fault, but all the same, it was a jangling start to my the camera.
But did that feature as a news item? Did you have to read out and finally? Just outside this studio, somebody got run over, not too badly.
Lots of people in Chimsad Choi. Luckily, I was driving very, very slowly and someone just walked in front of me and, you know, he was fine. But it was very dramatic and the police actually took me to the studio to get there in time for the news. So this fed into my adrenaline, my sense of, I just want to... you know, kill this. I just don't care what I do. I'm just going to have the most extraordinary experiences. And so, you know, there it started. And after I finished reading the news, I used to go on to Run Run Shaw's studios and dub kung fu movies into sort of a terrible transatlantic English accent. And I was always the kind of serving woman too, because obviously kung fu movies only have very good parts for men. Yeah. So my only job was to say, "Excuse me, sir, can I hold your sword?" And we'd all be smoking away. It was, you know, we'd do that till 2 a.m. I loved it. You know, this was so far removed from Croydon High School.
So you went to Hong Kong when you were 19. So you're talking about when you were 19, 20. How long did you stay in Hong Kong?
3 years. I made documentaries. I produced the Drive Time show on the local RTHK, equivalent to the BBC out there. Mm. Not knowing how to produce, I used to edit tape with my nail scissors and sellotape, you know, on a UR, which is an old-fashioned recording piece.
That's when editing was done on physically with pieces of tape rather than a computer.
And I used to ring my friends back at the World Service and ask them to send me by snail mail, because obviously there was no internet or email, they'd send me old scripts that had been on The World Today or Outlook or whatever, and I just used to rehash them and pretend I'd written them. I mean, but I just didn't care. And that's what I mean by the university of life, because you just fling yourself at everything. Some people stick, some things stick, some things you find you're very good at, other things you're terrible at.
Well, I don't know whether I think the politest term I think could describe this is as you had a lot of chutzpah. You're daring. You were ready to do it, even though it might be borderline bad activity.
Absolutely. I got involved with a terrible cult called the Children of God, only because a lot of men I knew used to get involved with this flirty fishing that they used to do in bars in the Hilton. So I went all the way to Macau to meet them because I thought this will go into my memoir one day. And, you know, I always felt very safe. No one ever tried to take advantage of me ever, I don't think. You know, they were quite respectful of me because I think I must have been a rather weird person, this very young person pretending to be 25, though I clearly wasn't. And quite safe. I was always considered, you know, not a threat to anyone. So that's why I got away with stuff, I think.
Well, we rather skipped over the fact that Spike Milligan sat beneath you during a broadcast. I hope that was just him being wackily amusing rather than anything more salacious.
He's being charmingly wackily amusing. That's what I mean. You know, terrible things always happen to other people, but no one ever tried. You know, I never had any terrible sexism or no occasions of anything like that. I just was obviously on a lucky run. So by the time I came back from Hong Kong, I had done, you know, 2 years at the BBC, 3 years in Hong Kong, University of Life, tick, you know.
Well, we're going to have to move on to your other wonders. But before we do, I should note in passing that later in life, you have done, I suppose, a university or a college. You've been to Chelsea Art School for quite a few years to study art.
Yeah, no, I did that in the 1990s when I gave up work for a while to be with the kids at home, and I went and studied fine art. But it was really funny. When I got back from Hong Kong, I went into BBC News to meet this I think his name was Bernard Joe, with my cassettes of me reading the news. And I said, please employ me, you know, because I always had this thing of having to move my life along quickly and earn some money. And he just looked at the tapes. And I looked about 12. And he just said, it's just not going to work on the BBC at the moment. Yeah. But it was a very, very intense, weird period of my life that one day I'll write a book about or make a film about, because you couldn't believe it.
All right. Well, let's come to Treasure Hunt before we leave this wonder. So, all these skills and bluffing and broadcasting skills. How did you get the job of being that? For people who don't know the program, there was a challenge to the people in contesting, trying to find locations around the country. And somebody had the idea that the best and the cheapest or the most efficient way to do this would be have somebody, and it turned out to be you, being flown around the country looking for these clues to find the castle or the canal or the burial site and physically do it.
Can you imagine a more exciting job to go straight into? I mean, it was really thrilling. You know, I came back from Hong Kong. I started as a reporter at Thames Telly, actually, in the interim. And then I heard about this audition, and I was sent along to Hyde Park, and they were looking for male sportsmen to be the skyrunner in this exciting new Channel 4 series. And the cameraman, Graham, and I raced around Hyde Park, and I literally heard him say to the producer afterwards, it'll have to be Annie. She's the only one I can keep up with, because the other men were very, you know, arrogant and just wanted to show how fast they could run, whereas we just had a bit of a laugh. But
The poor old cameraman obviously had the camera to carry, which is always the people forget about it when in like mountaineering films, that there's the mountaineer doing it and the cameraman has got a camera.
God, we had so much fun. But the weirdest thing was, no one before the first day of filming ever said, how do you think you'll be in a helicopter? Oh, and by the way, there are no doors. You know, and there was no health and safety. I was just flung into the North Sea, up and down mountains. But again, by then, I was so full of adrenaline and jeopardy from my Hong Kong years. This just carried on with it, if you like. So it played well into how I'd become. And also I'd found my voice. I was just confident, you know. So I was still very young, sort of 23 or whatever, but I had a sort of confidence probably that might have taken me a long time to achieve if I'd gone to the University of Birmingham or something.
Well, this definitely put you on the map. And you had a unique presence on television, and that led to the other things.
Yeah, well, I mean, up till that moment, Clive, I'm not joking, but women on telly were either draped across a car on the golden shot in a fur-lined bikini, or they were like Sue Lawley, who was my heroine, you know, behind a news desk or something. Mm. And so, you know, the programmes I did really broke the mold, because they put women absolutely at the centre of the action, in control, and you really, that was the first time that had ever been seen on television. It caused a sensation.
So anyway, I'm on the way. This is incredible, actually. These guys know what they're doing. They lowered me down on two ropes in a sort of basket. And it's sort of, I'm rushing against the mountainside, but they're totally in control. I mean, what a way to get a clue.
All right, well, that's a good note, but maybe we'll break the mood by going on to your second wonder of the world. What is that?
Oh, let's have a change of scene. Let's go back to early childhood and Cindy.
Cindy.
My doll, Cindy.
Now, a lot of people have heard of Barbie doll, but I think Cindy's still going. But Cindy and Barbie were deadly rivals.
Head-to-head rivals. Barbie was full of American glamour, lots of lipsticks, very pointy, big breasts. Cindy was a bit more homely. Came out in 1963. Her boyfriend Paul was released two years later. She had a sister called Patch. And Cindy and Patch, why they're so significant to me, and they're literally on my desk, and I still have the original dolls, the original clothes, all my original books from my childhood. For, you know, the same editions of What Katie Did or The Railway Children that I read in the 60s, because this band of characters became my family. You know, it's really important for me to have this family. Yeah. And I can't underestimate how important Cindy is for me. In fact, I did Grayson's Art Club last year on Channel 4, and I was given the subject of family, and I created a 6-foot frieze and actually started with Cindy and Patch. And the first thing I did with Cindy was I tore off the jumped the all-in-one boiler suit that Action Man had and put that on Cindy. So immediately she was all in one, ready for action. She had a little buggy. I mean, talk about nicking someone's identity in later life. But this family were very important to me because I had a weird situation at home in that both my mother and father would never divulge any information about their past. So I had no hinterland. I had no aunties, cousins, uncles, grannies, you know, all those things that most people would have. Yeah. The nearest I got to a granny was my mum saying to me one day while I was washing up, my mother died yesterday. And it just always gave me such a sense of shame because I didn't know why all these people were such secrets.
All right. And did you ever discover why they were secret?
No, Clive, it's been a big thing in my life. You know, it's so weird when you've grown up with such a secret, you almost can't embark on finding out what the answer is. It's very, people won't sort of really understand it, I don't think.
But well, you know how some people know that they will discover they were adopted and some people just leave it at that. But a lot of people, it becomes quite a quest to track down, either to meet their birth parents or at any rate to identify who they were.
I just feel my mother was evacuated during the war. She grew up in working class Deptford and she was evacuated to Leafy, Kent or Surrey or somewhere. And she obviously got there and thought, well, this is better. I can only think.
And didn't want to go back.
Didn't want to go back. And I know there were sisters and brothers and, you know, there's a lot of people I was never party to. But then to have my father with the same thing that I never met his brother and my cousins. Oh. From his side of the family, became so normal for me, but it did leave an aching void because I'm a very tribe-like person. I like to be in a team. So my team, back to Cindy, you know, that was my team. And this gang of, you know, Katie Carr from What Katie Did, Cousin Helen, Bobby from the Railway Children, these characters, I climbed onto the garage roof and I used to just sit there for days on end with this imaginary family.
But you mentioned you had a family because you did have a younger sister or younger brother who you looked after?
Yes, I did. And that was really important, my little baby sister. So when I, you know, but she wasn't born till I was 11. Mm. So up to 11, I had this frantically trying to create my sisters and, you know, uncles and aunties and people that I could call my tribe. So I've always, you know, it's really, really important to me, family, but I'm a great believer that actually family is just your community. You know, it's just, so I have lots of amazing communities in my life, my painting community. Mm. In fact, I went to see an amazing show in my early 20s called Chicken Shed. And it's an inclusive theatre company where disabled kids act alongside on stage with able-bodied kids and everyone helps each other. And I looked on that stage and I just saw a family. That is exactly what community is. And that is what, on the spot, gave me the idea for Challenge Annika. And I wrote it down and ran into the BBC and said to Michael Grade, can I do this program? And he said yes. Because I just thought, you know, that's what it's about. Community doesn't, so people, you know, mustn't feel worried if they've got a dysfunctional family or things aren't right at home, because you can find it elsewhere.
And Challenge Annika was a big success for you in two ways. One, you presented it, but it was your idea, so it's been done elsewhere in the world. It's your concept.
It's been a huge thing. It's literally my life's work, because it was about 30 years ago now. And I'm still in touch with most of those projects. And when I say in touch, you know, really love those volunteers and the people I met who are all now 30 years old. And there's just such a lovely feeling of legacy. And wherever I am in the UK, I'll always drop in on a challenge project, which will still be going strong. And then we sold the format in Europe. I had ABC in New York did a Challenge Annika with Erin Brockovich.
Yeah.
And I had this extraordinary, surreal thing where I had to go to New York and try and teach Erin Brockovich to be a television presenter. She'd never done that sort of work before. So we're running around Central Park and I'm just, you know, it's very difficult to explain to someone to be themselves in front of a camera. It sounds so obvious, but it's...
Doesn't suit every actor. Just in case anyone's listening to this who hasn't seen Challenge Annika, or what sort of projects are you... your top project or two that you did? We built
an amazing indoor arena for riding for the disabled in a city part of London, which is huge and magnificent, where disabled kids can go and learn to ride. We went out to Romania and renovated an orphanage. We actually went out to Croatia once, and it was after the Homeland War, and it was a school absolutely razed to the ground and in a terrible mess, and we just sort of cracked on and helped renovate that and restore it. And all the time we had Serb snipers in the hills trained on us, so we had to have the United Nations protecting us, and we all wrote letters home, left them in our hotel, because we just thought we'd never get out of there alive. So there are a lot of adventures, but mostly the projects were very UK-based and using the community to build something for the community.
I see. Well, just one last thing about Cindy before we move on. So when your sister came along, did you put Cindy to one side and all these sort of fictional family members, or do they carry on?
No, they carried on in parallel. So while I was looking after my sister and really leading quite a grown-up life, sorting a lot of things out in the family, I was still always secretly playing with my Cinders. I mean, really up to the age of 15.
Yeah.
Very significant to me. And as I say, they're people as far as I'm concerned. Are you actually going to send for some sort of paramedic to come around after this and take me away?
No. Your family history within your family is quite a sad one, and it might have broken, one person. You might be telling a story of how, but in fact, it seems to have strengthened you or inspired you to take hold of your life.
Yes, because I just found out that I was very good at this family community thing myself. So wherever I was, even as a young child, I always had loads of kids around me. I'd be telling them stories. You know, it was just, funnily enough, it fed into what I did in later life, which is very much embracing that community thing. Or who knows, Clive? Honestly, it was so weird, the whole thing, looking back on it. But I definitely... I can see where I came from. I can see the position I'm at now. Yes. I can work out why I'm like I am.
Can I just stop you for a second? Bit of work.
Hang on, what's going on here?
Your next challenge, Annika.
What's going on?
The toughest one you've ever done.
I don't believe this. At 9 o'clock on Wednesday, the 8th of September, join the children of pack rats in the former Yugoslavia on the first day of their new school term.
That's the easy bit.
P.S. Their school has been destroyed in the war. Renovate it and take as much relief as you can to help rebuild their lives.
It is the most difficult one you've ever done.
Is this for real?
It's for real, yeah.
Well, I hope at any rate in these first couple of wonders we've established that, as with a lot of people who have overnight success, there's a lot of development that goes into it, and hard work, enterprise and a foundation before you get to that overnight time. But let's go on to your third wonder.
Blue, Clive, colour blue. And I know I've always been obsessed with this because I've got all my old diaries from when I was 6, 7, 8, right through all my teenage years. I used to document everything obsessively, probably as a way of anchoring myself into this very weird world I felt I was in. And blue, my friends always used to give me blue things on my birthdays. I think it genuinely can cause the body to produce chemicals that are sort of calming and release sort of real feelings of calm and peace and tranquility. And I feel it. And, I love everything about it. I have a mood wall in one of the downstairs room in the house, and I'm always painting it a different shade of blue. Mm. Everything in the house is blue. I'll get up in the morning and I'll dye in the washing machine a duvet blue, or I'll get some leather dye and dye a chair blue. And I even painted the paving stones in the garden, little different blues on different little squares. They look amazing. So to me, blue is the only colour that resonates with me. And I paint now with Maggie Hambling, the amazing, probably our greatest living painter. I somehow seem to have bluffed my way into her masterclass. And she used to get, you know, go, "For God's sake, Rice," she pulled on her cigarette, "put the effing head in," or, you know, "Why is it blue?" And now I've sort of been allowed, I've earned my blue spurs, and still more or less everything I paint is blue. I see flesh that's blue. You know, it's just how I am.
Okay.
I love blue. I can't have a word against it.
Well, I assumed when you selected the colour blue that was just related to your painting, but it seems to permeate your entire life.
It permeates my entire life, and I just find it very restful. I remember when I went to Marrakesh and I went to the Marjorelle garden, and I nearly collapsed because every bit of the garden, all the fountains, all the walls, different shade of this fantastic blue, which is it's a blue modelled on the lapis, the
lapis lazuli sort of thing.
Lazuli, which is very rare and found in Afghanistan back in the day, and it, you know, it was became blue became a very costly commodity to make that pigment, and so artists have always been trying to recreate it. And during the 1950s, the French artist Yves Klein got together with a dealer in paints called Edouard Adam, and they produced this successful formula. So there's a blue called Yves Klein blue. And then, as I say, Jacques Marjorelle, who has this beautiful garden in Marrakesh, which was then actually owned by Yves Saint Laurent, he's got a different, slightly similar blue called Marjorelle blue. All right. So if you go into our garage, it's just blue paint everywhere. I love it. Really, to my mind, there's nothing as exciting as opening a tin of paint.
Nothing.
In fact, when my dad, who had terrible Alzheimer's, you know, and really lived in a parallel universe, one of the things I used to do with him, we'd sit and look through paint swatches, because one of the things I could engage him with was going, "Oh, so Dad, what do you think? What about that shed? Look, let's have a look at these, you know, the colour charts. Yeah. What could we use for that? And what about this for a tie?" And we spent hours doing this together. It was a really lovely moment of my life. And I always remember saying to him one day, "Dad, what do you think my name is?" And he looked at me so tenderly and just said, "Dulux," which sort of broke my heart. But equally, it was absolutely right that I should be called Dulux.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
What's your fourth wonder of the world?
Oh, do you know what? I thought I'd throw in the Isle of Wight.
The Isle of Wight? Okay.
Yeah, because I used to go on holiday there when I was a child. My dad would load up his Zephyr, light the pipe, and we'd get in and be stifled by cigarette and pipe fumes until we emerge spluttering the other end. It's not an ambitious holiday destination, Clive, but it'll feel right. I don't know whether you've ever been there, but I can't hear a word against it because it's just like a perfectly formed travel experience in itself. I've done so much travel in my career. I used to do Wish You Were Here, which was a holiday program on ITV, the holiday program on BBC One. Yeah. I cover China, you know, Africa. I did so many trips. So I
you never went to the Isle of Wight in those programs. So yeah, that was damn exotic as a.
I did go to the Isle of Wight. Now, I covered the whole, there's really not many, it's almost embarrassing if people go, I've just come back from the Okavango Delta. I have to stop myself from going. Yes, well, of course, I was there in 1982. I just have to stop myself. But the Isle of Wight, you know, it's tiny, but it, within the Isle of Wight, is everything you could ever want from a destination. It's got a microclimate, so it's a good 5 degrees warmer than anywhere else. It's got chalk cliffs and beautiful sandy beaches. It's got history.
It's got red squirrels, which is unlike most of England.
There's, you know, you'll have a flyby of overwintering Brent geese one moment. It's just gorgeous. So many large flocks of wildfowl. People, you know, love bird watching there. Divers and grebes and flora and fauna. It's really very special.
All right. Well, I have been there in later years, but it always features in my, when children of today are talking about going on school trips and they say, oh, we went to Vietnam for our school trip, or we're going to Morocco, these sort of exotic things that modern children sometimes. I say, yeah, we had a school trip when I was at school. We went round the Isle of Wight. We didn't even land on the Isle of Wight. We went on a boat trip which sailed round the Isle of Wight back to, I don't know, Portsmouth or wherever it was, and then back on the train and back home again. That was as exciting as it got in my day, in my school.
Yes, no, that's all people know. And so it hasn't, you know, it's not talked of with the love that I talk about it with. Yeah. But, you know, there are paleontologists love it there because obviously there's fossils, there's dinosaur fossils, there's Roman ruins, and obviously the huge influence that the Victorians had of it. There's miles of cliffs and sandy beaches and steep chines, which are these coastal gorges. It's absolutely staggering.
So do you spend a lot of time there?
Yeah, I do. I absolutely love it. You know, it's there's something just very gentle about it. It is slightly 1950s in a lot of ways still. But, you know, it has got quite a good sort of arty scene. Of course, there were the famous sort of Isle of Wight Festival in 1970 with Jimi Hendrix and Bob Dylan and everyone, where I, as a child, used to hang around the hotel where Bob Dylan was staying, hoping to catch a glimpse. And at this time, I have no idea who he is. I'm just hanging around because everyone else is hanging around. But, you know, that's sort of, you know, got the artistic thing moving in a way.
But did you bump into him or to anybody?
I was about 11. Yeah. Just, you know. But you've got Tennyson Down, which is this spectacular whale back ridge of chalk that rises to about 500 feet. Huge views. And of course, it's named after Alfred, Lord Tennyson. And he had a bit of a community set up. There was Charles Dickens wrote, I think it was, what was it, David Copperfield in the Isle of Wight. You know, there was a gang, there was a bit of a sort of, I don't know how you describe it, but artist community, definitely sort of commune going on.
And the Queen Victoria and Prince Albert, they loved it there.
Yeah, they loved it there. Absolutely loved it there.
Until he died, obviously.
And there's a fringe there now. Yes, until he died. But, yeah, Lewis Carroll, Edmund Lear, they all went and wrote there and were very inspired by it. And you can really see why if you go and visit. I mean, the crime is that White Link, the ferry company, or the ferry companies are, you know, owned by overseas investors, and so the prices are just ridiculous, with no love and concern for the community of people who live there.
Are there still hovercraft taking people to and from the Isle of Wight?
The hovercraft, which takes about 10 minutes, but again, that's expensive if it's a whole family. You know, everything is just an expensive place to get to, which is, you know, why it's not a very low per capita income. You know, it's not a rich island at all. But that's why, you know, it's difficult to get on and off and encourage trade and manufacturing.
That probably contributes to its character, though, doesn't it? It's a bit separate. If there was, a bridge, or if such a thing were possible, then and you could just drive on and off, it would be just like another bit of Hampshire, or another bit of the south of England.
It is. You do get on that hovercraft, you land the other end, and you just feel you've just, gone back to
1950.
Yes. There's a lovely Edith Wharton quote, which is, "Set wide the window, let me drink the day." And I always think of that when I'm in the Isle of Wight. I've reset myself. I'm in touch with the tides, and I just feel very centered and very happy. And it's where all my kids have had their holidays, instead of dragging them around the world too much, which I always associate with work. You know, we've had very basic sort of bucket and spade holidays.
Oh, they say, "Thank you. Thank you, Mother dear. We didn't want to go to Marrakesh with you. We didn't want to go to Morocco. We didn't want to go to Tuscany. We're so happy to go to the Isle of Wight."
As well, Clive. Do you know, I had it in my contracts back in the day that I could always take my kids with me and someone to help me look after them while I was working. They don't remember the trip to Hong Kong or wherever it was. So I took them round with me more, I guess, for myself, really, to otherwise I'd never have seen them.
Actually, we're in the Isle of Wight, and we're flying over the Solent just outside Cowes. Below me, you've got the most wonderful sight of yachts spinning across. It's a lovely, breezy morning. There's a couple of scoops going by with their spinnakers full up. Cowes is, of course, is the world-famous yachting centre, famous too for boat building, even boats that fly, like the flying boat and the hovercraft. It's a lovely island. It only measures 23 miles by 30 miles, so it's very small, but very picturesque. So I think it's going to be a good show today.
We, at least in the order that I had them in advance, we skipped over a wonder, which was the glory of the evening light, which might fit in with the Isle of Wight at this point. So tell me about the glory of the evening light.
Yes, the glory of the evening light. You know, I don't know about you, but sunset at the end of the day is just truly magnificent. We live in London on the river, and the sun sets over the river, and it's just the refrain in our house wherever the kids are, and they're all grown up and left now. I go, "Oh my God, the glory of the evening light tonight." You know, encourages them to share their glory of the evening light. I find it just such a heart moment, you know, and for everyone, you know, everyone loves the sunset. You can drive to your favorite spot, you might eat a bottle of wine and just drink it in. And the colours of the sunset result from this thing called scattering, which is when molecules and small particles in the atmosphere change the direction of the light rays, causing them to scatter and create these extraordinary things, you know, this absolute kaleidoscope of colours, which is just so lovely. And there's just something very serene. It's the end of the day, which I always like because I love going to bed. You know, it's just, there's nothing like a breathtaking sunset. So it's very much, I'm sure, it'll slightly be on my gravestone if I ever had one, just the glory of the evening light, because it's the refrain. I'm sure if you asked any of my children, they'd agree.
All right.
You know, me and the sunset. I just feel refreshed when I see a sunset. It's a lovely thing.
Well, I'm glad you've mentioned seeing this, the glory of the evening light in London, simply because there are a lot of places in the world that people get terribly excited. Oh, we have this marvellous sunset here.
Yes.
And you think, well, actually, you can get sunsets anywhere in the world. Of pollution that you get in a city
adds to it beautifully. And I've seen sunsets. I've filmed, you know, so much around the world, and I've sat watching extraordinary sunsets in Africa or in Colorado, wherever I am. But I've always been with a film crew, and it's not quite the same. Just say, it's not quite as romantic to say to your sound man, "Oh, isn't this beautiful?" You know, so what I love about a British glory of the evening light is that I'm usually with friends.
Friends or family, rather than, film crew can be jolly people as well.
I love my film crew, but at the end of the day, it's just, you know, it's lovely to share something so beautiful in a romantic way, I think.
And what about, maybe you don't ever see this, or you don't see this so often, what about the sunrise?
Because sunrise,
similar-ish colours.
Yes, sunrise is equally beautiful, and I love that as well. But it is the glory of the evening light, because it's just the way it hits our house, and it just streams through the windows we have. And so you have this lovely view of the river and this sofa, which is just bathed in hot sunlight. And when my children were very little, I'd just bathe them when they just had their bath, you know, on a towel with this warm bathe of light over them. And it was just my most sort of spiritual memories of the whole thing of having small children. It was this calm we all felt when we were bathed in this light.
We're going to come.
You're going to get the paramedics.
No, we're going to come back to the children in due course. But we've got we've now done five wonders. So let's go on to your sixth wonder, who is a broadcaster,
David Attenborough. I mean, if you've been watching The Life of Plants,
yes,
the first week he's up in a sort of crane over the rainforest in South America, and then the second program he was rowing down the Amazon River or something, and then the third program is sort of lying nonchalantly looking at tiny plants. I love this guy.
Yeah,
he's had a pacemaker fitted, he's had double knee replacement, and he says, if I was earning money by hewing coal, I would be very glad indeed to stop, but I'm not. I'm swanning around the world looking at the most fabulously interesting things. Such good fortune. Yeah. He does, you know, what I love is that he's being allowed to carry on working, because, you know, that is extraordinary. I just hope, you know, you don't often hear of women of 95 still sort of working, but I'm hoping that, you know, that's hope for all of us, that if you're an expert or if you're good at something, you can just carry on doing it. And, you know, I love the way when he joined the BBC as in the fledgling TV service, he didn't own a TV of his own, didn't really know what it was, as no one did. He'd only seen one programme in his life, but he's just part of broadcasting history, isn't he? And he's part of the BBC I've known since I joined it in 1976, which is 46 years ago. But the one thing I feel very I can share with him is that he was actually discouraged from appearing on camera because Mary Adams, his boss, thought his teeth were too big. And when a producer, when I was doing my training course, said, you know you're busy in the on the world service here, but have you ever thought of being on TV? And I went, no way, no. But they said, can we try you out? And so I was sent to the Bristol Natural History Unit to be tried out for something to do with Animal Magic or one of those programs.
Yeah.
And afterwards, the producer wrote to my boss saying, not too bad as in the audition, but the trouble is she'll never have a career in broadcasting because of the gap in her teeth. And I've kept the letter. And it was such a put down. I just remember thinking, well, I didn't want to be on television anyway. What bloody rude. So I loved when I found that out about David Attenborough, that he also had teeth gate.
Yeah. Well, you don't have a gap in your tooth anymore, so things have to, oh no.
Not the same gap. No, but exactly.
No, I know what you mean. I know. It's extraordinary. Once somebody's face, and indeed their voice is recorded, but their face is put on camera, everybody feels entitled to, they've got an opinion about you and say, well, that's a bit too this or that's a bit too that. But you know, nobody knows who's going to be good on television, really. And
luckily we've gone past those days where you had to sort of be physically so perfect or the right shape or the right this or the right that. Because now if someone said, you know, you can't be in our show because the gap on your teeth is too revolting, I could probably sue them for millions, you know.
So we've got David Attenborough. To be honest, he's not the first time he's been mentioned as part of the wonders of the world, and I'm happy to endorse that. I suppose his age is sort of epic, isn't it? Because he's about the same age as the Queen. He's about the same age as the BBC. He's been a presenter, a producer, a controller of BBC Two, and then he decided, I don't want to do that. I don't want to be in control of things. I just want to make these fantastic programs. Yeah. And what is it about him, do you think? His authority, his voice quality is so impressive.
Voice quality, he's kind, isn't he? There's a kindliness and an absolute authenticity and sincerity about him, which I think is, you know, if someone can speak and you see truth in their eyes, they're a good television presenter.
Sure. Although he's of an age now, he retains that sort of, it's almost boyish enthusiasm for the subject that he's telling us about. And
exactly. And all the things I remember from my childhood, like, you know, Man Alive, you know, the Monty Python's Flying Circus, Arena. He was the civilization, the centre of man. He's in charge of the BBC at time, and it's because of him that all these programs started up. So what a legacy, what a legacy. And as I say, it would be just great if we could all feel that we can carry on broadcasting if we're still good at it, you know, end off.
The ability of plants to reclaim the most unlikely sites is truly extraordinary. Given time, they will attract animals, rebuild complex communities, and even reclaim bricks and mortar for the natural world.
Thank you very much. So we've done six of your wonders. We've got one more. What's your seventh?
This is a bit weird, but I would like to put giving birth down, because honestly, what a blinking wonder of the world that is, and how has evolution not caught up with us? I mean, other mammals don't have the same problems that we do. Two reasons: their heads aren't so large relative to their body size, and they don't walk upright.
Yes.
And so we're just caught in this ridiculous evolutionary wasteland of not catching up with everything. And I didn't realize it's actually a thing. I wrote it. Where is it? It's called the obstetric dilemma.
Yeah.
Because to run fast, we need a narrow pelvis, but to give birth easily, we need a wide one. Yes. But if women had hips any wider than they do now, they wouldn't be able to run. So I'm lucky that I've managed to give birth and run. But the natural selection hasn't happened, because of course a lot of people have elective cesareans now. People have got maybe very narrow hips, so their gene hasn't sort of been washed away, because, you know, back in the day, just everyone died. I mean, it's the most brutal, extraordinary thing, isn't it? How has evolution not happened that we have to carry around, a bit like marsupials, some little handbag where we could just get our little baby out of? That would just really...
Well, it's a balance, isn't it? Because we need to have big heads because of the sort of creature we are. But the bigger the head, the more difficult the birth. But if we have it too big, then the mother will perish.
Yeah.
But if the head isn't big enough, then the baby is not developed enough that it takes years to take a baby from you know, puking and mewling into something like man or woman's estate. So it's a
You're still working on it in your case, aren't you?
what do you mean? I haven't made it to man's estate yet.
No, but women with very narrow pelvis would not have survived birth, you know, 100 years ago. They do now, and they pass on their genes encoding for a narrow pelvis to their daughters, and because of cesarean and modern interventions, thank goodness. But it has meant that we haven't really moved forward on that. But, you know, I don't know.
Well, things have moved forward a bit in the sense that there was a time when women just kept giving birth to loads and loads of babies, because you needed to have 10 or 12 to hope that one or two might survive. And generally, not generally, but quite often, it killed the mother or killed the last child or both. So we've got it a bit better now in the modern world. Most babies thankfully survive, and almost every mother survives the experience. Oh, gosh.
I always remember giving birth to my first son. Luckily, because at the time I was so intensely well known, it was a bit of a nightmare. So there were always press camping on our doorstep. So I went to the Portland Hospital, you know, which is where sort of royalty is, just to have some sort of security. And even then, some photographers were dressing up as doctors and trying to get in.
Yes.
Of me breastfeeding or whatever, but it was so dramatic because of all this, you know, people trying to break into my room and everything. But I and after Thomas was born, I had a hemorrhage, and so I had to, you know, be treated for a few days there, which was utterly gorgeous. And my little baby was just taken away and looked after these lovely Irish midwives. For some reason, they all seem to be Irish. And all I want to do is take them all home with me. And I remember one morning when I sort of came to, probably on about day two, and I woke up feeling much better. And I thought, oh, and there was a room service menu. And I thought, oh, lovely smoked salmon scrambled. So I rang room service and said, oh, hello. Yeah, room 7 or whatever. Could I have the coffee and the smoked salmon and scrambled egg? Oh, and also, could you bring up my baby? I didn't know how else to find my baby. But it did mean that we had this wonderful 4-day start to life, and that by the time we both left, we were so rested and calm and recovered. Whereas, you know, yeah. It can be very brutal that first day or two, I think.
That's so fantastic. So the wonder of giving birth, it's the wonder that it even happens because it's so difficult. But for you, it was a wonderful experience. It a joy to have the baby as well as the joy to have the room service?
Joy, and I had a lovely doctor who understood the word epidural very thoroughly. So, you know, the whole thing was lovely. And then my husband was just positioned on my right-hand side with my lipstick so that I just kept it. And it was absolutely lovely. But, you know, it is brutal. And in the animal world as well. So they haven't done, you know, a lot better, have they?
No.
Four species that die soon after giving birth: the octopus, the squid, salmon, and the common mayfly.
Not great. There's the black widow spider as well, who mates with the male and then eats him.
Can I tell you about the spotted hyena? Females give birth through a narrow penis-like enlarged clitoris, and their offspring emerge from this almost indistinguishable from the male penis of the species.
Right. And you mentioned this, why? Is it?
Just because it's interesting.
It's an interesting fact.
Interesting fact about giving birth. It just doesn't seem very straightforward.
Well, I was thinking is that I was present for the birth of all three of my children, and it is a wonderful moment if you're the father watching this new creature come into the world. But of course, I'm not in the position, the agony, the difficulty. So I think fathers do experience the wonder of the moment in a way that perhaps it's hard. I'm imagining it's hard for the mother actually going through it to look back on.
Well, it's a hell of a thing, isn't it? That 9 months of pregnancy and your body sort of stretched in all sorts of directions. And there's then the recovery period. It's a thing. It's a thing. It's a full-time thing. Having said that, I after Thomas was born, I did zoom back to jumpsuit shape quite quickly, because I always remember I had the challenge. Annika, you know, producer, saying, "Come on, we got to get back on location." And I remember there's Ayrshire or somewhere, and I'm running up a hill, and I turn to the cameraman and go, "This can't be right. I've just had a baby." Oh my God. Yes.
So anyway, it's not quite the same. It's so stressful. Well, the time of my first baby being born, I was a barrister and I'd been in court during the day, but then on a Friday, but then on the Saturday, I was recording two episodes of Whose Line Is It Anyway? And so one of the people I had to call to tell him that the birth had happened was my producer, because the baby wasn't born until about 5 a.m. So I was able to phone him up eventually and say, "Yes, the baby's been, but quick, how soon can you get to the studio?" "All right, you know, it's my first child. Let me just enjoy." And so I arrived and recorded the program with no sleep at all, but I still think it was one of my best recordings. So I was beaming with pleasure.
I bet you haven't had your birth on telly though, because I always remember just before I was about to give birth, I was about 8 months pregnant, I walked through the sitting room, and this used to happen a lot. There were just so many people like Bobby Davro or Mike Yarwood impersonating me the whole time. Anytime I walked past the television, there was someone in the jumpsuit. The Carling Black Label ad, they had an actress flinging herself off a cliff and falling into the sea, and then, you know, the camera crew would come out of the sea and they'd two old guys would go, "I bet she drinks Carling Black Label," or whatever. And Spitting Image decided to, and you're not told in advance, you just walk into the sitting room, and there you are, the latex puppet, going, "Oh my goodness, my waters are broken, I'm going to have a baby." And then Kenneth Kendall pings into action, and it's the funniest thing. It makes us all weep with laughter now. At the time, I just thought,
how dare they intrude into your personal life?
Very funny, because Kenneth Kendall is literally going, "Okay, Annie's baby, you're in the birth canal. Keep going, you're doing very well."
Well, we've come to the end of our time, but I think we've got through a lot of your life and a lot of your wonders. Thank you for sharing your seven wonders with me. I have to choose the the wonder of wonders from your list of seven, the one which struck me as particularly wonderful, as you described on this podcast. Yes. And there's no question about it. Your last one, giving birth, has to trump all the others. It is an extraordinary thing, and yet it's an everyday thing, because it's a moment of magic and wonder when it happens. And yet, if you think about it, millions, billions of times, this very same thing has occurred and presumably will carry on occurring till the end of time. But nonetheless, it is a wonder of wonders. And Annika Rice, you're a wonder of wonders. And I will thank you very much for joining me on this particular podcast.
Thank you, Clive.
My Seven Wonders with Clive Anderson is a Stack production in association with Alaska TV and powered by the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.